D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com. Welcome to the Geeks Menagerie. This is Green Lantern.
And this is Roy Folker.
And on this episode of Retro Comics, we will be discussing Rachel Summers and the British super team Excalibur in their debut comic, The Sword is Drawn. This special edition format was, I guess it was in a magazine format. How would you describe the special edition book?
Yeah, I would call it a magazine comic.
Because I think it was one of the last ones that kind of kept that same theme. Because New Mutants did the exact same thing with their first one. It was essentially a magazine size edition.
Yeah, they went to sort of the size format that Conan was in.
Right, Savage Sword.
Yep.
Cover date on this issue was 1987. And the writer was Chris Claremont, penciler Alan Davis, colorist Glynis Oliver. Inkers were Paul Neary and Mark Farmer, letterers Tom Orzechowski and L. Lewis Buhalis. And the cover artist was Alan Davis.
The main characters in this comic are, we break down into the heroes, the villains, and the others. And for the heroes, it's the primary Excalibur group as they're forming, which includes Brian Braddock, who's Captain Britain, Kitty Pryde, who is Shadowcat, Kurt Wagner as Nightcrawler, Megan, and Rachel Summers, or the second incarnation of Phoenix. The primary villains in this one are the Warwolves, which are sent out by Mojo in order to recapture Rachel Summers, which sort of creates the whole storyline. The others include Saturnine and the agents that she sends after the Phoenix Force, which includes Gatecrasher, Technet, Pharaoh, China Doll, Body Bag, Thug, Waxworks, Scatterbrain, Blix, and Ring Toss.
So at the beginning of this book, Kurt and Kitty are recovering from their wounds from the mutant massacre, where they both got messed up pretty bad by the Marauders. And they're on Moira MacTaggert's Island off the coast of Scotland, where they're doing a little healing and trying to deal with the fact that they're kind of messed up. Nightcrawler has issues teleporting, and he gets exhausted pretty quickly and can't do it quite as well. And Shadowcat is basically in permanent phase, and she has to concentrate extremely hard in order to keep her body solid. At the same time as this whole thing takes place, the X-Men, as far as the rest of the world knows, is now dead. During the Fall of the Mutants, they apparently die in Texas. So, and that's the premise behind how the team is formed. Rachel returns to Earth from the Mojoverse while being pursued by Mojo's Warwolves. While at the same time, the Omniversal Magistrix agents are sent also to recapture her. And in the process, the team known as Excalibur is formed.
And it was really kind of funny because the Omniversal Magistrix agents only got sent because in order for Rachel to escape the Mojoverse, she had to call upon a large portion of the Phoenix Force, which caused that Phoenix Starburst to appear all across the universe, which was kind of like a giant kick-me sign on her.
That's true. And that's also kind of a hint to how the Excalibur storyline runs for a couple of years, actually. It's the fact that Captain Britain is completely tied to the multiverse, and the people that he works for later on that are trying to control dimensional time travel to prevent, well, the end of existence in certain realities. So you see a lot more of the Saturnine and Captain Britain in later issues.
Yeah, he comes off as kind of a moody middle-aged player, so it's kind of interesting.
I think the hard part, I think, at the beginning of this book is if you at the time, you know, you got to remember this is 87, 88 when this book came out. If you hadn't been reading anything that happened with the X-Men, you'd be kind of lost. I mean, I think people kind of knew who, I mean, people knew who Nightcrawler was, and they knew who Shadowcat was, and they knew who Phoenix was. Even though Phoenix at this point had only been in a few scattered issues. After issue 141 and 142, where the Days of Future Past storyline, she doesn't actually make it back to the 616 universe until issue number 18 of the New Mutants, where she just appears out of the blue. And then she does end up eventually hooking back up with the X-Men and kind of did some stuff with the team until she's recaptured, or until she's taken by Spiral to Mojo's, to the Mojoverse, where she becomes a celebrity reality star.
And yeah, the significance of the story really is that it does set up the foundation for Excalibur, and it really helps to sort of quickly identify each one of the characters, because, like, for example, Captain Britain, up to this point, I had no idea who he was, and I didn't really care. Megan, same sort of deal. Actually, I don't even know, to this day, I don't know what Megan was in before this. If she was even a character.
As far as I know, nothing.
Okay, so. But, with, Brad X's sister being Psylocke and getting caught up in the fall of the mutants, it creates this tie-in between the X-Men and this newly formed Excalibur, where they're all brought together off of the same sort of shared tragedy. And each one of them carries sort of a different burden as to what they felt their responsibilities were and how they need to either repent or deal with the situation, with the exception of Rachel and Megan, both of which who are kind of disconnected, but they're connected to the characters who are involved. And they have to try and justify their needs against the needs of the people that they're trying to help. So it's kind of a fun sort of build-up.
Yeah, it's. I just like the fact that you're, if you take your mind out of the bigger picture of, you know, what was going on in the X-Men books, now you're looking at it from Kitty and Nightcrawler's viewpoint. The people that they've known for who knows how many years at this point are gone. So they don't really have a connection to anybody anymore. Everybody that they knew is dead. You know, so the fact that they, thanks to Rachel, which, spoiler, it is actually her idea to form Excalibur because, well, let's face it, she's a woman out of time and she has nowhere to go.
Yep.
Especially since, as far as she even knows, the X-Men are all dead in this timeline now, so.
Yeah, her abilities are limited to what she knows, and with Mojo having messed with her so badly, she doesn't really know anything anymore. She understands, she can relate to people, but she only knows the people that she's met at the beginning of the storyline, which is kind of a neat little sort of reboot for her character, and it's also kind of a nice lead-in for both Kitty and Kurt to basically build up their own and not be the side characters of X-Men, but to be these main headliners in Excalibur.
Right. And Kurt does end up kind of becoming more the impromptu leader for the team, more than Captain Britain. Through at least the early part of the series, Captain Britain's a bit unstable, yeah. To say the least.
It's fun to watch an alcoholic superhero.
Exactly. Well, we'll get to that in a second. But I did want to say you were curious about Captain Britain's background. I had only read just a little bit of his stuff. It looks like his first appearance, he was the Marvel Comics UK brand. So in between 1976 and 77, 39 issues were put out of a standalone Captain Britain series. And from that, looks like 1985 to 86 was the second series. And from this point, they jumped right into Excalibur. So, obviously not being from the UK, I don't think most of us read much of anything from about Captain Britain, unless you were lucky enough to get a black and white collected edition, which was about the only way you could read them here in the 80s.
That's funny. I knew more about his sister than I knew about him.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess he was in some of the X-Men comics here and there when Psylocke had joined the team. Yeah. But there wasn't a whole lot of, too much tie-in other than the fact that you knew, oh, yeah, he's the UK super being.
Yeah, the Captain America of the UK without a shield.
Yeah, but with Superman's powers, basically.
True.
Invulnerability, super strength, flight.
And basically immortality. Not just invulnerability, but all-in-out immortality, as it sort of seems to be.
True. And it also brings up the other question of, what is Captain Britain? Because in the early stories, Cap actually dies and then is brought back to life as Captain Britain to be the protector of Great Britain. So, and it's mentioned at the beginning part of this book, too, that he still can't quite figure out why he's alive after he had died. And he's trying to come to grips with that fact because now that his sister's dead. And he couldn't do anything to save her. So a lot of psychological issues that they're kind of dealing with at the beginning of the book. It's kind of interesting. The book starts out with Kitty, who, as we find out in a couple more pages, that they're at Dr. Moira Mategert's, I think that's how you pronounce it, her island compound, and she's having trouble sleeping, and all of a sudden she finds herself being held down in a makeup chair, and people are putting makeup on her and doing her hair. And then they put her in her costume and they shove her out on stage. And the first big splash page is they're on a TV set, and all the X-Men are there. Rogue, Colossus, Storm, Psylocke, Longshot, Dazzler, Wolverine, and Professor X is the director. So obviously, you can tell she's a little confused.
Yeah, and they all seem to just not even care of her existence immediately. So that was kind of fun.
There's a creepy scene. She taps on Psylocke's shoulder, and as Psylocke turns around, you see that there's no eyes on the character's face. It's like a mask. And then she puts these little things over her eyes, and all of a sudden she has eyeballs.
And she just stares at her, too. It's just a creepy look.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's, on people's uniforms and on equipment, it they've got the thing stamped, Mojo's New World Project, or what's this one say? Oh, I'm sorry, not Project, it's New World Picks. For those of you that don't know, the Mojoverse is in quite a few of the X-Men stories in the mid to late 80s. And Mojo's entire universe is based around reality TV, or scripted television, where they capture people from different dimensions and force them to be in television productions. And it's all about the kind of ratings. Whoever has the most ratings, gets the most viewers, makes the most money, and has the most power.
Yeah, one of his favorite ones is the Battle Arena that he has a few different people run through, but yeah, this one seems to be centered around the dramas.
Yep. As we follow Kitty's progress, she's still a little dazed and confused as to what's going on, and all of a sudden she sees Rachel, who in the actual comics hasn't been around, I think, in 2 years. Is it either 2 or 3 years, I think, since she actually appeared in one of the X-Men books. And so they have a little conversation, and obviously it breaks Rachel out of whatever mind influence Mojo has over her, and she uses the Phoenix Force to break free. And then just as Rachel leaves the scene, the bodies of the X-Men, all these weird silver metal, like Mercury-type creatures pour out of the carcasses of the X-Men and attack Kitty. Only for her to wake up screaming in her bed, not realizing what the heck is actually going on.
Now, when I first read through that, I actually had to read it twice because it's been a while, and I was trying to figure out, okay, what is actually going on here? Am I missing something? Because it seems so confusing.
And once again, classic Chris Claremont. And then once again, as we had mentioned earlier, Kitty's outside, and then she sees the essentially the Phoenix aura appear around the rising sun on the horizon.
And don't they show that in a few different frames of different places that see the Phoenix Force appear?
They show it, the same scene, except this time it's with Megan, and she's swimming in the ocean with a bunch of dolphins. And she just comments on how beautiful the sunrise is. And then, of course, she's at Captain Britain's lighthouse, and as she goes back inside, she sees the news report talking about the death of the X-Men in Dallas. And then she wanders in, seeing Captain Britain getting loaded, drinking some hard liquor. Yeah, and he gets pissed off, and if it wasn't for the throwing of the booze bottle, it looks like he's about to slap her upside the head.
Yep. That would actually be an interesting fight, because I think if Captain Britain actually ever did snap and attacked her, I think she could actually take him.
She probably could, because she is a shape changer.
Yep.
Well, needless to say, after watching Megan and Brian have a relationship, obviously, and so she's a little bit freaked out and doesn't know what to do, so she decides to go seek out help, and so she leaves. Now, the next page I really, really, really like. Ellen Davis's style is just gorgeous, and I'm pretty positive that The Sword is Drawn is the first book I ever saw him draw in. Although, he might have done some X-Men books by that point, too. I know this wasn't his first work. But anyway, back on the island, Kurt is in the danger room. Because apparently if you're somehow associated with Professor X, everybody has a danger room.
Well, if I remember the story correctly, Moira and Professor X actually built the entire environment together. And so, yeah, there was always a danger room on the island and in the X mansion.
Yeah, well, they did date for quite a while, too. So that's probably when they built everything. But, so he's got Nightcrawler's got the danger room all set up with bars going in every possible direction all over the room, and he's fighting a bunch of musketeer-styled hat-wearing swashbuckler robots, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, he's trying to pretend to be D'Artagnan, isn't he?
Something like that. He loves the Three Musketeers.
No.
And the best part is he has a sword in each hand and one on his tail. And he's fighting all these robots as he's flying around and teleporting. Unfortunately, he doesn't, he sets the danger level a little bit too high, and he nearly gets his butt handed to him because his teleportation powers are still on the mend. So Kitty ends up saving him by shorting out the electrical system in the danger room.
Yep. And it was kind of, it was sort of by accident. She ran in to find out what was going on, and because of her powers being out of phase, when she came into the room, she went through the control panel, and right now, if she phases through any electronics, she shorts it out.
I think she has to concentrate on that, though, doesn't she? Because
she used to. In the Excalibur storyline, she no longer needs to. She actually runs into problems with that later on.
Oh, okay. Now I want to reread the whole series again.
Oh, I plan on going through as much Excalibur over the next month or two that I can.
Just for our listeners, so you know, just for ease of use, because obviously I think I own 3/4 of the Excalibur series. But it would be way too easy for me to actually go find the long box and take those issues out. So I went out and bought the Marvel Excalibur Classic trade paperback. And so that's what we're using to do our little review here. And this book contains The Sword is Drawn and issues numbers 1 through 5. But we're not going to go into 1 through 5 because this is about them forming the team for the first time. So we thought this would be a good one to go with. And if you want to know more about the series after we're done coming up with our lame version of reviewing it, you can go out and pick these up. And I recommend them. They're really good. They're a nice trade. They're not too big. They're relatively quick reads. And they're real nice. Real nice pages. They're colored beautifully. And for reprints, they're really nice.
And it's a fully contained storyline, which is another great thing about it. So you're not left on some cliffhanger or missing some side parts. It's all a complete self-contained story here.
Good point. So after Kitty rescues Nightcrawler, she kind of cusses him out for being stupid. And they do a little bit of soul-searching, talking about their friends who are, you know, as far as they know, are no longer with them. And just as they get done having their discussion, that's when Gatecrasher shows up. And this is quite the shock, because you've never seen these guys before. Gatecrasher is a extremely large, heavy-set female blue-skinned alien. And hanging on her neck is this
annoying lizard.
He's not really a lizard. I don't know what he is. He's a weird orange-skinned alien that allows him to open up portals to teleport. And you find out that they've been sent by Opal Luna Saturne, the Omniversal Magistrix. And her job is to is responsible for the maintenance of order and reality in this sector of creation. And you find out that Brian does actually work for her. But yeah, so they're sent to recover the Phoenix and send her back to her original timeline so that she doesn't mess anything up in this timeline.
I thought they were there to remove the Phoenix, was kind of the way that they were describing it.
Well, I will read you line for line what is written here, because the image of Saturne is projected in front of them, and it says, "Great Crusher's TechNet." Wow, that's a weird line. "Are my duly authorized agents responsible for the apprehension of this threat to reality, more commonly known as Phoenix, who is believed to be en route to Sol 3, the planet Earth. I hereby charge and require that the inhabitants thereof, as a sentient species, offer all appropriate assistance in this endeavor."
Yep. Yeah, they're talking about they're there to get her and basically, arrest would be the closest connection to it. But, yeah, they consider the Phoenix Force a threat to the universe. And they're apparently not alone. A lot of people seem to think that, but, yeah, Jean and Rachel have never really seemed that big of a threat in anything that I've ever read.
Yeah, I think it's because the Phoenix Force attached itself to Jean that the Phoenix Force itself was relatively contained.
Yeah. And, Rachel has done a really good job, other than the Dark Phoenix period, of really holding on to the Phoenix Force.
I don't think Rachel really ever goes dark.
Really?
She's got anger management issues, but the Dark Phoenix doesn't come out when she's in control of the Phoenix.
Oh, so it was only Jean that did that.
Yep.
And she really wasn't even that much of a threat when she was the Dark Phoenix. They've ran into a lot worse.
True.
But, okay, overanalyzing.
Well, at this point, you get a nice big splash page where the rest of her agents appear, Body Bag and Waxworks and everybody else, and they show up to convince Excalibur that they need to help. And after a little bit of and Megan shows up also, because she apparently knows Rachel and Kurt and had showed up to ask them to go help with Captain Britain, because he was a little messed up and she didn't know what to do.
Now, is Rachel there at this point?
At this point, not yet. As we go from Megan and Kitty both get captured and are shoved into the gullet of Body Bag, which is kind of a disturbing image. He literally grabs them, coats them in a goo, and then swallows them up like a snake.
Oh, and by the way, one of the largest plot holes in the entire series of Excalibur is that right there. Because at that exact moment in time, when Body Bag touches Kitty, she should have immediately phased.
Kitty was unconscious.
The moment she goes unconscious, she should have phased.
Here's how the scene goes, right? She is intangible, and she starts running, and then Scatterbrain basically hypnotizes her and makes her pass out.
That's right.
She's solid, and she hits the floor, and that's when Body Bag picks her up and stuffs her into the bag. Or its back, I should say.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I get for not having a copy on me.
So then the next page starts with the actual appearance of Rachel in back into the 616 universe, and it's pretty cool. She's wearing her hound outfit, which is the red, I'm assuming, spandex costume with the spikes on it, and all of her limbs have collars and chains attached to them. And as she falls into the dimension, she lands into the middle of a party. But when you're looking at the picture, you can't tell if she's in our dimension or if she's in another one, because everybody's dressed up like the Mad Hatter and a giant rat and a whole bunch of different characters. And, of course, she's freaking out. They think that she's showing up to wreck the party that they're at, and they try to capture her. And then the werewolves appear, chasing her, and there are 6 werewolves that appear out of the same place that she came through into the dimension. And we find out that the werewolves are immune to her telekinetic powers. Actually, I think all of her psi powers.
Yep. They have a natural immunity towards any directed attack towards them. Basically, they can only be hurt with physical damage for the most part. Otherwise, they absorb any other type of energy.
Right. Well, after a little scuffle with the werewolves, she throws one of them through the wall, and as she crawls out, you find out that she's actually in London. And then a chase ensues, and she heads off to the London Underground, to the subway system, to try to escape. And in the process, uses the Phoenix Force and fries one of the werewolves on the tracks. Which is, so far, the first thing that she's killed. on her return to the universe.
She's off to a good start.
Well, in her defense, the werewolf was asking for it.
Yeah.
So then, from this, we move on to back to the lighthouse. And Kurt shows up. And drags a drunken Brian Braddock outside of the lighthouse and throws him into the ocean. So, yeah, they sit there and have a heart-to-heart for a little bit. And Kirk gets pretty pissed and throws him up against the wall and gives him a little bit of a lecture. And then walks away. And Brian has a tantrum and punches the floor. Which he does a lot in, like, the first couple books. I don't know why. He's got some issues.
Yeah, he's going through a midlife crisis of some sort.
Well, I mean, in his defense, his sister is dead, so.
Yeah. And he's already dealing with a lot of baggage and an over-clingy girlfriend.
Yeah, well, that's the other good part, too, about Brian. He is a ladies' man, and there are a lot of them. it turns out, yeah, he has a love affair with Saturnine, and some chick from a bank too.
The Ice Queen.
Yeah, there you go. Couldn't remember her name.
Yep, she shows up just a little bit later in the story.
I just love the fact that there's these little, not so subtle hints dropped throughout the book. Like at the beginning, in Kitty's room, there's a big poster on the wall that says "Excalibur, the sword is drawn," and. And Rachel's walking around downtown London, and there's a flyer in the window, and it says Excalibur on it. And in the window, there's a little display of a sword stuck in a stone, like a little statue.
Yeah.
Now, here's the best part, right? So she's kind of in la-la land thinking about the fact that the X-Men are gone, and she gets grabbed by Body Bag. It goos her and swallows her up. And, of course, the rest of Saturnine's agents are there, and they're quite happy that they managed to capture her already. And then everything falls apart because the werewolves show up, and a big battle ensues.
Yep. And, yeah, they were not ready to take on the werewolves.
No, they weren't. Yeah, and Captain Britain and Nightcrawler show up. And they free Megan and Rachel and Shadowcat. And there's a pretty sweet fight between all three groups. And it's just funny because Kurt makes a reference to the fact that, wow, they fight as a really good team. Too bad we're not doing that.
Yeah, and that's the thing I loved about the agents are that they are the most motley group of people. But their powers complement each task that they need to perform so well that what would normally be a collection, or any individual one of them, is a completely worthless mutant. But as a team, they are an incredibly good capture and retrieval group.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are all definitely extraterrestrial. They're not Earth-based creatures.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the nice thing about this little fight scene is not only does it, you know, kind of continue the story and plays it out to figure out, you know, okay, we're freeing everybody, everybody's kind of all on the same page now, but you actually get to see the fighting styles of each one of the agents. Because each one has a, like Blinks can literally change the density and weight of a person. So there's the scene where Kitty's trying to run away, and Blinks comes up, and literally puts like 180 or 200 pounds onto her. She just gets huge. No, probably more than that. It looks like there's three panels. She goes from normal to like 400 pounds and then like 1,000 pounds. She kind of looks like the Blob. And she's just sitting on the ground because she can't move.
Yeah.
And then Waxworks, literally his little tentacles, if you hit somebody, that turns somebody into jelly, basically. Kind of like Mr. Fantastic without the ability to actually move your limbs.
Yep. And what is Ring Toss's ability again?
He literally throws out a whole bunch of rings to capture people.
Yeah. Hence, Ring Toss.
Yeah, exactly. And they also Oh, yeah, yeah. That's his powers. He creates and controls them with his hands. And then, obviously, Scatterbrain uses illusions to trick people.
And then that leaves Pharaoh.
Yeah, where is that crazy bugger? Let's see here. Oh, yeah. I forgot about China Doll.
Oh, yeah.
China Doll actually, well, when she touches you, you shrink. Down to, like, a quarter of your size. And that's the best part. That's how Kitty ends up knocking out Gatecrasher. So she goes from being, like, a 9-foot-tall giant alien down to right about Kitty's height. And she gives her a sweet left hook. And she gets knocked out.
Beautiful.
So now, all of TechNet gets the entire group and teleports them away, and the werewolves escape.
Now, do all the werewolves make it out, or I thought one of them got lost in this fight as well?
It looks like they all get away.
Okay.
So only one of them has died.
At this point. Oh, yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah, the book's nearly over. And then a couple of nights later, they're having a little bonfire, and they're all sitting around chatting up, sharing stories. And as Brian's about to say, okay, well, we're out of here. Have a good night. And Rachel goes into a little bit of a speech about how they should stay together and form their own team in honor of the X-Men to carry on Xavier's dream. And using the Phoenix Force to great effect, yeah, bringing up a fiery image of King Arthur and the sword Excalibur, and finishing off with a giant flaming firebird in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah, the Phoenix Force is something that's just impressive, and I do get a kick out of whenever it's whenever she really taps into it, the Phoenix image ends up getting created either around her or on the horizon or in front of a sun, depending on how much power she's expending.
Well, and I think it's all perception, too. You know, the one where it was around the sun was literally because she was returning to Earth. But for the most part, she likes to do it where it envelops her body.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was more just a statement of the scale in which you see the Phoenix Force. So, I mean, imagine how big it would have to be hanging out above the sun.
Well, true. I mean, I guess technically that would probably be like an aura effect or an illusion, I guess.
Yep. All right. Well,
that brings us to the final page where it shows the whole team kind of standing there arm in arm, celebrating the fact that they decided to become a team. I think the only one that's not really on board at this point is Captain Britain. He's just doing it because Megan wanted him to.
Yep. And they all become a big, happy family.
A happy, dysfunctional family.
Well, for this comic, at least.
Right. Yeah, you find out about all the other weird, sordid psychological details that each one of the characters is dealing with as the first, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 issues of the story plays out.
Yep.
My mind is aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Ditto.
Ditto? Ditto, you provincial putz.
So, for the art, I give it a 5 out of 5. Like I said previously, I love Alan Davis and his inker, Mark Farmer, just because the two work so well together, and they've worked on a lot of projects since this. They even recently came back to the Uncanny X-Men a couple of years ago and teamed up again and did I think it was like a 4-issue story arc. I think the thing I love the most about Alan Davis's style is the fact that his characters look realistic. You don't have the, even in the 90s when they got a little bit too explicit about, you know, big chesty female heroines, You know, how bodies were just misproportioned. It didn't look right. All of these characters, even the aliens, they're all completely proportioned the way you would expect them to look. Well, except maybe Captain Britain. He's a little bit huge on the old top head, the chest portion. You know, depending on which scene you look at him in. But yeah, I mean, the characters look human. They have flaws.
Yeah. I agree. I give it a 5 out of 5 myself. This is the kind of art style that made me fall in love with comics. Which is kind of sad because this is the first time I've read this one. So it was a really good experience to get into the story and to really appreciate this Excalibur you've talked about for so many freaking years after I had started getting burned out on X-Men.
Yeah, I don't know why you doubt me. There's so many good books that I've read, and you're like, nah.
I didn't doubt you. It was just I'd gotten burned out on the Fall of the Mutants really did burn me out on comics. There was a big portion where, at that point, I didn't want to deal with any of these large groups or the X groups because, they're just going to reboot the story, or they're just going to do this. And so I started following the off characters, like... Yeah, that was about the time I started getting into Silver Sable and...
Cloak and Dagger.
Yep. And started going with all the alternate characters. Elektra was really big at that time. Stuff like that. But getting to Excalibur, I now kind of regret not having read it back in the day. But it's still around, and now it's time to pick up the graphic novels and read it that way.
Well, and, you know, and I have to agree with you. The whole multi-crossover thing... pretty much was killing me. I think at that point, Fall of the Mutants was still pretty good. I would say by Extinction Agenda, yeah, because it was Inferno and then Extinction Agenda. And Inferno was not very good. But Extinction Agenda, or was it the other way around? I don't even remember. That's how bad it is. But either way, Extinction Agenda was probably the last one that I read that I thought was... a pretty good story, just because it tied in X-Factor and the X-Men and the New Mutants into one big crossover. But the problem was there was just too many damn issues. You had to buy like four comics from three different titles just to get the entire story. And some of them even had individual spin-off books. Like I think Inferno had like a one-page spin-off in Captain America, Iron Fist... and like two other stupid books that didn't make any connection whatsoever to it, but they did it just to get people to buy it, and that's kind of the reason why I fell away from Marvel and I didn't really like them much by the 90s.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. All right, well,
moving
on to story, and story, I give it 4 out of 5. The beginning was a little bit disjointed. However, once the story really got going, it gets into sort of developing the main character. It builds on a potentially long-running conflict with multiple antagonists and a sense of purpose. But all at the same time, you know, the characters really have a reason to be where they're at and to do what they're doing. So, I don't know. The story really... really felt well put together and well thought through.
I give the story a 3 out of 5. And the reason why I say that, it's a pretty good story. I mean, the key points for me that I really enjoyed were the fact that they finally brought Rachel back into the X-Men universe. And it was nice to see them move away from what they've been telling for 30 frickin' years and moving it to a whole different continent. So now you had a couple of X-Men characters intermixing with British characters working in London or around the UK, which was pretty cool. It was a nice change-up from everything else. I think the overall story itself, it moved fairly well. It wasn't hard to follow. I think the end was rushed a little bit. Once you get to the final battle, it looked like, okay, we're on a deadline. We need to cut like 10 pages from the book. Oh, okay, well, we'll just rush it to this point, and then we're done. So that's why I only gave it a 3 out of 5. I think the end was a little bit rushed, and there were some parts that were a little too disconnected. But that's kind of the way some of the Claremont's writing style was from the 80s, too. So,
well, yeah, I can see that. And but the cool thing was is that the plot, that I'd give a 5 out of 5. Because, I mean, it was a really great start to a great series. And doing it with that whole cat and mouse scenario gone wrong with one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe playing the part of the mouse. It was a definite buildup and humanization of all the characters where, yeah, you have two incredibly powerful characters in the Marvel Universe, Captain Britain and Rachel, and both of them are very vulnerable, very humanized in this.
Ditto. I also give the plot a 5 out of 5. I think you summed it up pretty good. Yeah, the whole plot, the whole premise behind the book was excellent. How did you think the character development, how did you rate that?
Well, I actually broke down my character development by each one of the characters, and I give it a 5 out of 5. Excuse me. I broke it down by each one of the characters, and I did give it a 5 out of 5. Each character is very well developed, and they don't waste time on developing the character and take away from the story, but they make the character's development a part of the story. And here you have Kitty, who's lost control of her phasing and constantly has to focus on being corporeal. And you have Rachel, who's lost all of her memory. More precisely, Mojo has run her through reality TV so many times that she can no longer tell what's memory and what was a Mojo set. Nightcrawler just seems to have disconnected from everyone, but at the same time, he's starting to develop. Well, actually, at this point, he hasn't yet. So I'll redo Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler has seemed to have disconnected from everyone. He's sort of taking on this more responsible, more focused aspect while trying to hide behind this weakness that he seems to feel, so he's got to be a stronger person.
And I think part of Nightcrawler's deal, too, is the fact that he wants to protect Kitty because she's pretty much the only thing left that he has that has any sort of tangible connection for him because all of his other friends are gone.
Yeah. And then you have Megan, who is, you know, trying to deal with the fallout of Captain Britain. And she, you find out she's very over-obsessive, very, very much needs to be loved, needs to be a part of something. And Captain Britain is a wallowing pile of self-pity and regret going through his own form of midlife crisis. With his sister dead and his with his sister dead and his girlfriend unable to give him space that or to truly understand him, he's really kind of in this odd position between what he feels he needs and what he feels he has to do, his obligations in life. So, and they really actually do kind of build up these sort of initial introspections of the characters, and there's more information as the additional books go along, but it's impressive how they build it into the story.
Say what you will about Chris Claremont's writing style, but one of his strongest abilities, in my opinion, is the fact that he can take a very short amount of material and get you to understand how a character is thinking. I mean, let's face it, for how many characters are in this book, you get a real feeling for what the agent's motives are and how they interact with the people they're trying to capture. You understand what Captain Britain is going through because his sister's dead, and he's going through a lot of other regret that he's trying to deal with. Shadowcat, who is still pretty young at this point, is still trying to recover from her own injuries and still grasp the fact that everything she's known since she found out she was a mutant is gone, as far as she knows. You know, Megan, on the other hand, Megan is, I guess, essentially she's a fairy folk. And so her mindset is more of a child. So she doesn't even know how to read and write. I mean, she leaves a note for Captain Britain saying that she's going to go over to the island to get Kitty. And all it is a picture of her flying with an arrow to a picture of a little sketched island. So, you know, I mean, it's all these little things that are just kind of thrown in to get you to get more of a feeling for what the characters are. So to get past my babbling, I also give the character of a development a 5 out of 5.
Moving on to continuity, what do you think about it?
Continuity. Well, like I said, I guess I kind of rambled this off a little bit at the beginning, but I give the continuity a 5 out of 5. And the reason why I'm doing that is, let's take a Doctor Who reference. The Sword is Drawn is literally a fixed point in time, to take it from Doctor Who. Without this, the timeline would, I think, collapse, because it is literally set right in a pocket where, you know, if you look at the bigger picture of the world, the X-Men are dead, the Fall of the Mutants has just happened, and so there's this giant hole in the fabric of what the storytelling is in the Marvel Universe at this point. So if you hadn't read any of the X-Men stuff, this was a pretty cool little side note. You're like, oh, God, I don't have to read about these 18 mutants in a story. And plus, it's in London, you know? That's one heck of a change from what the X-Men had been telling since the 60s. So, for continuity-wise, I give it a 5 out of 5. It's one of the great pivotal... God, why can I not say that frickin' word?
Pivotal.
Pivotal. Yeah, what we just said. I'm trying to be serious, and I shouldn't be serious, because this is a fun discussion. It's not supposed to be serious.
Exactly.
I still prefer the fixed point in time, though, because I think that is the exact wrap-up of what I'm trying to say. You need this in the Marvel timeline.
Yep, and yeah, you hit on exactly my thoughts behind this. I gave it a 5 out of 5. I think it's a pinnacle point in the Marvel Universe. Marvel was at a point of superhero overload in the late 80s, with X-Men turning into a revolving door where there's a multitude of different factions and groups with different agendas and ideals. Along comes a group that is a cosmic peg in the overlaying complex world that Marvel's created. They're a series of completely different mutants, even from each other, with no seemingly meaningful connection. And while both Kitty and Nightcrawler were X-Men, if you look at any of the X-Men storylines before this, there's no real connection between Kitty and Nightcrawler at this point. They're friends, they've worked together a lot, but they never developed as two individuals together. So to see all five of these characters come together and bring together the storylines going back to... Even, what was it, 3 years before this when they did the, we already did the retro comic for this one. What was the name of that story?
You mean Days of Future Past?
Thank you. God, that's so dumb. bringing in the whole Days of Future Past, where in that Kitty and Rachel were great yeah.
It was actually 7 years.
Was it 7 years before this?
Yeah. Holy 141 wow. Came out in January of 1981.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. Even 7 years back, you have a character who's supposed to become Kitty's best friend, all of a sudden getting introduced into the timeline, and the two of them, even though they've had a little bit of interaction, really... never hit it off in the way that it was portrayed in Days of Future Past.
Right.
And all of a sudden, yeah, that connection is there. All of these characters meet up, and the ability for Kirk to stand up as a leader and fill in this sort of gap where Fall of the Mutants created. And this was really something interesting that Marvel had done. I was impressed.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I've always loved this book. I think, if I remember correctly, I probably read the book up through probably around the mid to late 20s. Because I think pretty much by about 93, I was done with comics. I pretty much stopped for like, I don't know, 8 to 8 years probably before I went back to them again. Just because the 90s pretty much killed me of it. But Excalibur was pretty much one of the last books I read. Because even later on down the road, they added a whole bunch of extra characters. So essentially it became another X book.
Yep.
In the grand scheme of things down the road, which is part of the reason why I stopped reading it. But at least the initial run, the first 10 to 12 issues is by far highly recommended. Plus the problem is too, is once Alan Davis left the book, it was kind of hard to continue reading it. Because trust me, some of these artists that worked on it after he left were really bad.
He was the glue that held the glue together.
Well, you know, and sad truth is that's kind of what happens to a lot of books. You get a good writer, artist, inker combo working on something, and once that story arc is done, I think in the 80s they did longer story arcs than they do now. I think now it's somewhere around 4 issues, and then a team will break up and go to a different book. Sometimes if you're lucky enough, you will get teams that stay together and just move from book to book doing, you know, 4 to 6 issue runs. But there's not a whole lot of creators that stay on a book for a long, long, you know, multiple years at a time anymore.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare. And I'm sure that has something to do with pay. You know, there's the whole structure of how they pay artists now is a lot different than it was in the 80s.
Yeah, and yeah, the politics of it, I'm sure, has taken its toll on the way that everything interacts and the way that the information is presented to us now. So it's not as, I wouldn't say it's not as good as it used to be. It's just not as consistent, I think would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah. As a person who still reads modern comics, I would say the last 5 years has probably been the best story-driven comics I've probably ever read. Obviously, these books from the early 80s, that's when I was a kid, so yeah, these will always top, you know, most of the stuff that I'm reading now. You know, there's still some good artists, luckily, which is kind of a switch, and maybe it's just because of my age, too, but I find I'm more drawn to books that are written better than they are drawn. And when I was younger, it was the exact opposite. I didn't really give a crap what the story was, as long as the artwork looked pretty and shiny.
Yep.
Which is probably why the 90s went so apeshit and everybody, you know, that pretty much almost destroyed the market. Or actually, it did destroy the market. But yeah, I mean, there's a ton of brand new books that, all the books from the Valiant Universe, the relaunch, Exo, Harbinger.
I've been forgetting to get those.
Bloodshot. These books, Shadow Man, it's a good book. It's not quite my favorite out of the batch. But, they're all great. I mean, Archer and Armstrong, I tell you what, if Valiant could get Barry Windsor Smith to come back and do one issue, I would probably die of excitement.
You would probably buy up the store.
I just love Barry Windsor Smith. He did a lot of great work on the X-Men books. He did a ton of work for Valiant, doing Exo and Archer and Armstrong. And I don't know, you lose track over time of how much stuff he does. But as anybody who has looked at the Facebook page knows, I am completely in love with the Batman Beyond Unlimited series that they're doing right now. All of the Batman Beyond comics, as you can find them in trade or even loose issues, highly recommend just buy them. They're beautifully written. For the most part, the art has been really good. There's been a couple of runs where they were a little iffy. But I cannot talk up that book enough. It's just awesome. And it's those books are all based on the Batman Beyond cartoon. Jeez. I could probably go on and list about 14 others, but I, you know, that's getting off topic of what we're here to discuss right now. But,
but all in all, I would say, yeah, going back to the actual comic we're reviewing.
Ouch.
I would say that Excalibur the Sword is Drawn probably is in the top 10 of, greatest comics ever written. Or not necessarily, well, yeah, I would say greatest comics ever written and top 10 of must-read comics ever produced.
I will not argue that point. It is definitely, I think Excalibur's, I think Excalibur might be nudging close to my top 5. Actually, I think it is in my top 5. Ooh, hey, yeah. That's an idea. We'll have to do our rundown of our top 10 comics of all time at some point.
All right. And as a preview, you should know right off the top of your head what my number 1 is. It is Wolverine number 4. Hands down, greatest comic ever written, in my opinion.
From the ongoing series or the mini?
The original 4-issue mini.
Okay. It's pretty hard to beat that.
Yeah. And then it's kind of hard, I can't tell, but anywhere between 1 and 6 of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is number 2. I'd have to go back over them. I know that there's one of them that was just thoroughly impressive, but...
To be honest with you, as much as I love the original 6 for TMNT, I think my personal favorite has to be the Donatello one-shot.
Yeah, when they did the one shot for each character.
Yep. And Donatello's not by far not even close to my favorite Ninja Turtle, but for some reason that book, the way the panels were drawn, the way certain scenes were done, that book just sticks in my mind as one of the my early favorites. Hmm. But pretty much anything from TMNT, anything Eastman and Layard did was Layard. Yeah, I think that's
Laird.
How you pronounce it.
Laird. Yeah.
But,
yeah, we could go on reminiscing forever, though. We should probably wrap this up.
that's for another show.
Exactly.
So, in closing, let's see, what do we have coming down the pipe here for the Retro Comics episodes? I did post a thing on Facebook a night or two ago regarding what our plans are for the future. We do have some, we still need to do our Animation 101, which I believe we're going to do Transformers, which hopefully will be here in the next couple of weeks at the latest. But it is summertime, so you have to give us a little bit of a break on how quickly we're getting these out this time of year, because we are pretty busy with real life things and families.
Yeah.
For Retro Comics, I know we have a few things in mind. I know everybody's thinking, God, why do they keep giving Marvel all the fucking love?
Well,
it's because that's what we read a lot when we were kids.
How about we do this then? The next Retro Comics, instead of actually reviewing a comic, we'll do our top tens.
Well, that'll be a good one.
Yeah.
All right. So we're gonna do a top tens episode. We're also going to go into Vertigo's death, correct?
Yes. Yep. And I'll have to look for the specific storyline, but we're gonna take one of the death graphic novels and just go over, you know, basic spiel, look at the art and the story and give it a once over, give our impressions of it.
So yeah, basically we're going to do a Retro Comics episode.
Yeah.
Look, it's only 10:30. We're getting a little punchy tonight.
Yeah, if my webcam was on, this would be me flicking you off.
I don't care.
All right.
I also plan on the two that I'm planning to do, Usagi Yojimbo from Fantagraphics. I have the 2 hardcover slipcase edition. So I may not borrow that to you because I don't trust your family. But I will let you read some of it, and so we can go over that. And then I'm thinking at some point... which might be a month or two down the road yet, but I kind of want to do an overall of Conan comics, from Marvel to Dark Horse.
That's a lot to digest, but yeah.
Like I said, that'll be one that maybe we can work on, but that one I do want to get into because Conan is huge. And instead of just focusing on just, say, Savage Sword or the Marvel comics, the regular comic edition or the Dark Horse stuff, it'd be kind of nice to just do an overall genre just because the Conan stories are great. And there's so much of it out there that you can get. I think it would be fun to go over and give people some ideas of what they can look for.
Absolutely. I mean, he was an incredible character, and it's always fun to go over Conan. Especially when it doesn't include Arnold. No, his movies were good.
Just and, not Arnold of now.
Yes.
Sorry, people in California. It's just a fact.
And then we have, for RPGs coming up, I have been challenged to a Juicer versus Veritech Rift Standard Rules set, one-on-one battle. A friend of mine believes that nothing can beat a fully pimped out Juicer, and I still stand behind the theory that if you fire enough missiles at it, you can kill anything using a Veritech.
And I, of course, will be GMing the combat, so hopefully we will get that together here in the next few weeks so we can get that recorded. Let's see, I am also going to be working on an Icons campaign, which I will be running this fall, so plan on hearing some actual play podcast from the Icons game. And I think we're going to do an RPG Corner episode of character creation for that one. Once we get a little bit closer to actually getting ready to start the game. Friends of the show who have been on before, Chris and Kaylee and Greg and Roy are going to be there for that. So that should be a lot of fun. We need to pick some other RPGs to look at. So if anybody has any suggestions, please drop us a line. Let us know.
Yep. And then coming up in a couple weeks here, I will be going to Convergence. So, yeah, I know I really don't post much in the blogs, but I'm planning on posting a little bit of information on the different panels that I go to, and I will try and get some pictures up of the different people and things that I run into there.
And you also need to interview cosplayers and other crazy stuff, because Convergence has tons of crazy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Live from the floor. And as far as I know, Chris and Kaylee are going to be there. So
nice. Yeah, maybe I'll do a little bit of talking with Vampire Hunters Union and maybe with Anime Detour and see what's going on with them and get some updates going there.
See, look, people, we've got a plan. We just don't always have time to do it.
Exactly. Real life.
Yeah, it sucks. What are you going to do? But that, I believe, is going to do it for tonight's show. And thanks for listening, everybody.
And be sure to check out our friends on D20 Radio. This is Roy Folker.
And this is Rodney Ford, a.k.a. Green Loon Turn. Good night, everybody.